May it please the court. My name is Matthew Grove, registration number 34269. I'm here today on behalf of Colorado State Treasurer Walker Stapleton. There were probably at least half a dozen issues in this case that deserve attention, but because my time is limited today, I would like to focus primarily on what I believe to be the two most important issues that are presented. First, what is the scope of the treasurer's and indeed any pair of trustees' fiduciary responsibility? And second, whose job is it to decide what those responsibilities are and how a trustee may go about satisfying them? It might be best to start by talking about the traditional role of trusteeship and just what the pair of boards' fiduciary responsibilities are. Traditionally, co-trustees are co-tenants, each of whom owns undivided fractional legal title to the corpus of the trust. That ownership is subject to fiduciary obligations with respect to the exercise of the ownership interest. Along with legal title, though, comes full responsibility for not only understanding the requirements of the trusteeship and the trust itself, but also prudently managing the trust property. In the case of a public pension, such as PARA, prudent management also means taking steps to ensure that the trust will remain viable in the long term. In short, a PARA trustee has responsibilities to more than just the beneficiaries who are currently receiving money. He also has a responsibility to ensure to the best of his ability that benefits will be available to those who are contributing to PARA now and will be entitled to receive benefits in the future. So how does a PARA board member's role as a trustee square with traditional common law responsibilities? PARA and its outside counsel have taken a variety of positions on this question throughout the pendency of this case. In fact, those inconsistent positions started before the case even really began. In the district court, PARA maintained that the board's fiduciary duties are delineated by statute to the exclusion of the common law. In the briefing here, PARA appears to back away from that position, but its substantive arguments really remain exactly the same as they were before. In fact, the answer brief, I think it's at page 18, states that a trustee is not entitled to information except where such information is sought to provide benefits and defray expenses. This language is lifted directly from the statute, 2451-207, and while the statute is accurately quoted, PARA is incorrect to suggest that it represents a complete catalog of a trustee's fiduciary responsibility.
Let me try to short circuit this if I could. Tell me, please, what exactly in the record shows that the specific information requested was relevant to any duty of the trustee, whether it be by statute or at common law?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. The first answer is that that inquiry is not necessarily it. That's not the treasurer's burden to answer, because the treasurer, as a trustee, has unfettered access to any information that's held by the trust. Second, there are a lot of reasons that the trust that the treasurer there are a lot of things that the treasurer could have made use of this information for. For example, the treasurer, as a trustee, has five responsibilities. There are five standard common law fiduciary responsibilities: the duty of loyalty, the duty to monitor, the duty of prudence, co-fiduciary responsibility, and there's one more that's slipping my mind right now. But so, for example, the treasurer said, "I need this information because I need to understand how the trust works."
And well, so, isn't that all set by the statute? I mean, he wanted information on the top 20% of payees. All the formulae are set by the statute. So what does that particular information, how does it contribute to his discharge of a fiduciary duty?
The treasurer, and indeed the entire board, has a responsibility on an annual basis to sign off on the comprehensive annual financial report that's put together by PARA. And so that is prepared by the staff of the trust, and it is presented to the board, and the board says yes or it says no. And that information is then shared with the governor. So that's one thing. That contains actuarial projections. It contains information about what the trust is doing, some of its investments, things like that. What the treasurer is, the information that he's looking for here, it could pertain to a lot of things.
Well, be specific, please. What exactly does the top 20% of the payees contribute? The money's already been paid.
If the treasurer or any trustee perceives that there are, that the system is being gamed, for example, with people buying years for prices that are not at current market value, it's his responsibility and the entire board's to identify that problem in the comprehensive annual financial report, and perhaps to go to the settlor of the trust, which is the General Assembly, and advocate for changes that will ensure the long-term viability of the trust.
But that's not what he asked for. He did ask for, give me information about what years are being purchased for, or the being, he asked for information relating to the top 20% beneficiaries.
He also asked for the last 5 years of their salary, which could be good, which may very well go to whether their salary is spiking going on, and whether the input of these individuals into the Paris system is commensurate with the amount of benefits that they're ultimately going to get out. There are a lot of connections that can be drawn. That's just one of them. The bottom line, though, is that the treasurer, it's not incumbent on him to explain these things to anybody.
Why not?
Because the common law says that the treasurer has an absolute right as a trustee to any information that's held by the trust.
So, and I don't mean to diminish you by taking a ridiculous example, but suppose he asked the whoever keeps the records how many of the top 20% beneficiaries were left-handed. Would he be entitled to that information, even though it's obviously totally irrelevant to any of his duties?
Well, that's presuming that it's, first of all, available, that the trust would have that information. And if left-handed people were somehow getting more benefits than others, then absolutely, yes, it would be. If there was some way that left-handed people were able to game the system because they signed differently or something, or signed in a different place, it is a ridiculous example, but I could certainly perceive of that being relevant. The point is that those questions are not questions that the Para Board should be in a position to ask. What if the treasurer is asking for this information because he's concerned that people are gaming the system, or he's concerned that benefits are not being calculated properly for this 20%, top 20%, or he's concerned that legislation is about to be introduced that would allow salary spiking like that? He should not be put in the position of having to justify to the remainder of the board why he needs that information, because the remainder of the board, if they decide that they don't like it, or they just don't like him, or they don't like the way that he presented the request, could just simply turn around and say no. When they do that, they usurp the position that this court is in. The judiciary is the only authority that is in a position to comment on or dictate the scope of the treasurer or anybody's fiduciary responsibility in this case.
Assuming that we agree with your argument to the point of remanding, would it be your objective that our decision address who has the burden of proof as to relevancy, for lack of a better term, of the information the treasurer requested?
Undoubtedly. I don't think that a remand is necessary in this case, because I think that the facts as presented and the law as presented should just lead to a straightforward reversal of what the district court did below. But yes, there's no question that the burden of proof is an important question here, and there's no question that by imposing the burden of proof on the treasurer in this case, both Para and the district court, Para didn't reverse the error, but the district court did.
From your perspective, have you sufficiently briefed what I'm calling the burden of proof question?
Have we sufficiently briefed it?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to tell you that I am not in the top 20% of people receiving a pension.
I feel your pain, Your Honor.
Okay. The statute's 2451207. Makes it the statutory duty of Mr. Stapleton and others to act, quote, solely in the interest of the members and benefit recipients and for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits and defraying reasonable expenses incurred in performing such duties. My concern is you have Mr. Stapleton, Treasurer Stapleton, believing he has the right in order to fulfill this, to ask for unfettered discretion, but we also have the countervailing interest of the other co-trustees who apparently feel that it's not in the best interest of the beneficiaries. How do we, and the court has to decide that ultimately, how do we manage to make that decision?
If one trustee thinks that this is not in the best interest of the beneficiary, that is not a sufficient reason to deny the request for information. The only circumstance, and this is a very narrow one, is where there is an actual, blatant, obvious conflict of interest. And so if you look at some of the cases that are cited here, almost all of them, actually, I think everyone that I've seen, arises in the corporate director context. And under Colorado law, corporate directors and trustees have the same basic fiduciary responsibilities. So the best one, I think the best example is Tritech Telecom, which is cited in the briefs. It's a California app case. And in that case, a director of a corporation asked for information. It was actually attorney-client privilege information that was possessed by the board that he could use to help him prosecute his shareholder derivative suit against the corporation. And so he said, I'm a director. I'm entitled to any information that the corporation has. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to use this to help sue the corporation and get money back. If you look at all the other cases that Paris cites on this, this is sort of a prevailing theme. In some of the other cases, the director asks for information for trade secrets, for example, because he wants to split off and start his own new company. And so these are real conflicts of interest that the treasurer doesn't have here.
Well, I think that really conflates the response to Judge Rothenberg's question with the fact, though, with particular facts. Is it your position that by majority vote, the other directors can never reject a demand for information?
Not unless a real, actual conflict of interest exists. And on the record here, there was no such conflict. The fact that the treasurer holds dual roles, for example, as the treasurer, as a statewide elected official, and as an ex officio trustee, that doesn't create a conflict of interest. If it did, he wouldn't have been put on the board by the General Assembly in the first place. The fact that he may use this information to advocate for what he sees as something that's necessary for the long-term sustainability of the trust, that can't possibly be that conflict of interest, because he's doing what he's doing on behalf of the trustees as a whole.
The statute that Judge Rothenberg read said trustees shall carry out their functions solely in the interest of. So, who has the burden to decide, or the burden to show, that this request is carried out solely in the interest of the members? Is there any law, you feel like you briefed adequately what the law is on who has the burden to show solely?
I would certainly be happy to submit supplemental briefing on that, Your Honor, but the burden, the presumption, the centuries-old common law presumption, is that the burden is on the party who is trying, on the remainder of the board who is trying to deny him access to that information. The treasurer says, think about it in a situation where the treasurer, for example, has uncovered malfeasance, or somebody, not the treasurer, but any trustee in a large group of co-trustees. And he says, give me this information, and the rest of the board says, why? And he certainly can't say, well, because I think that all of you have your hands in the till, because then they would just turn around and say, well, no, you can't have it. And so that is the general common law reason why the treasurer or any trustee should not be required to carry the burden and justify his information request in the first instance. If I could reserve the remainder of my time.
If it may please the court, good afternoon, members of the panel. My name is John McDermott, and along with my partner to my left at the table, Carl Schock, we represent the Colorado Public Employees Retirement Association. To the left of Mr. Schock is the Acting General Counsel of PARA, Mr. Adam Franklin. The well-established two-hat rule provides that the fiduciary with two hats must wear only his or her fiduciary hat when acting as a fiduciary. Cutting through all the other issues in this appeal, Mr. Stapleton's request for documents was improper because he violated the two-hat rule and therefore breached his duty of loyalty at the time he made his request. This appeal can be resolved, we respectfully submit, on that ground alone. Mr. Stapleton initially filed this lawsuit both in his capacity as a paratrustee and also in his capacity as a state treasurer. He brings this appeal as well in both capacities. That in and of itself reflects that Mr. Stapleton is seeking this information in two capacities. But the record contains much more evidence that when he made the request, he did so in two capacities and conflated two distinct roles. His own statements, conduct, and legal positions, first at the para board meeting, then at the trial, and now on this appeal, demonstrate that Mr. Stapleton breached his fiduciary duty by violating the two hat rule.
Is that a factual question? Like, which hat is he wearing when he made this request? Is that a factual question?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The record is clear below from his own statements that he sought this information in his capacity as state treasurer. He stated, for example, during the board meeting that he was seeking the information as part of his responsibilities to the people who put him on the board, that is, Colorado residents and taxpayers at large. That is his state treasurer's constituency, not his para constituency. He further argued that his concerns as state treasurer differed from those concerns of other para trustees, again, because of the larger constituency that he represents. If there was any doubt that Mr. Stapleton was seeking this information in part in his capacity as state treasurer, he removed that doubt in his arguments before the trial court. For example, he argued that when he acts as a para trustee, his quote constituency close quote includes the millions, quote, millions of Colorado residents whose taxes support all instrumentalities of state, including para. He later clarified an oral argument through counsel that he was referencing to the people of the state of Colorado, in other words, his political constituency as state treasurer. He also stated that he sought legal advice from the Attorney General as a statewide elected official of Colorado.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but it sounds like what you're saying is those are issues of fact, but they were resolved as undisputed and against him by the trial judge. Notice he wasn't acting solely in the interest of the members, he was acting in his other, maybe it's semantics, but it seems like an issue of fact, but it was, are you saying it was resolved against him by the judge?
Your Honor, under Rule 56H, as you know, the court can rule on issues of law in the absence of any disputed issues of material fact.
That's what I'm getting at. Is there a dispute here about whether he was acting solely or whether he was acting not solely?
We believe, and the trial court certainly believed, that the facts below, based upon his own admissions before the board at the time he made the requests, where he indicated clearly that he was wearing two hats at the time that he requested the documents, show that he was in fact wearing two hats. And indeed, as you know from the briefing, Judge Bronfen, at the inception of oral argument, asked the parties if he could consider certain information in the record up to the point at which, up to the board meeting, and both parties stipulated that he could. We respectfully submit this is not a situation where there's any dispute as to whether he was wearing two hats. And let me just add one other thing in response to counsel's argument. He stated that it's necessary for para to show an actual conflict, which might, one could imagine, raise a disputed issue of fact. That's not, of course, what the statute requires. The statute requires not that there be a conflict merely or but that the para trustee act solely in the interest of the members and beneficiaries of para. And based upon Mr. Stapleton's admissions during the board meeting, based upon the positions he took before the trial court, and frankly, we think based upon the positions he's taken before the Court of Appeals, he is admitting that he is different from the other paratrustees, and that, and his statements during the board meeting reflect that he felt he was different and had greater responsibilities.
Respecting that remand is not the result you're seeking here, were we to remand, should our opinion address who has the burden of proof? In other words, does he have the burden of proof to show that what he requests is relevant, for lack of a better term, under the sole purpose rule, or do your people have the burden of proving that it isn't?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it of course is our position that once the undisputed facts show that he was acting in two capacities and therefore breaching his duty of loyalty, there was no proper purpose that he could provide at the board meeting, since in fact he was wearing two hats. However, if there is a remand, it is Pera's position that the particular trustee should have the burden of proof.
And you would want us to address that if we remanded, the burden of proof issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you feel you've adequately briefed it?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Let me address the issue of whether or not Mr. Stapleton gave a proper purpose for his request at the board meeting. First of all, of course, as I said a moment ago, since he violated the two-hat rule, we don't believe he could provide a proper purpose. But it was interesting, many of the questions that the court asked Mr. Stapleton's counsel a few moments ago are precisely the same types of questions that Mr. Stapleton was asked by other board members during the board meeting. And if you've had an opportunity to read the briefs, which I know you have, or even the transcript, you will see that. There were numerous questions asked, and Mr. Stapleton gave varying answers, including as to what I plan to do with the data. I really cannot tell you because I believe that is premature. I can't really tell you about my objectives until I had actually seen the data. I may have no objectives. And Judge Webb, your question about Mr. Stapleton requesting data on left-handed members of PARA is actually not that ridiculous, in the sense that Judge Bronfen asked counsel for Mr. Stapleton, what if Mr. Stapleton came to a board meeting and asked the other trustees and demanded that information on Judge Warren Martin be provided? He wanted all the information on Judge Warren Martin. He could give no reason and might even give a nefarious reason. Would a parent in that situation be required to provide that information to Mr. Stapleton? And counsel's argument was, absolutely. Access is unfettered. It is clear that even today, Mr. Stapleton has no ability to identify any purpose for his request, much less identify any purpose that he was given, that he was able to give during the board meeting.
Suppose a trustee comes in and let's say he or she is a very learned person and says, well, I'm good at this, I want all the information that exists from PARA about everyone. Forget the 20%. Just I want to know so that I can do my job. Give me everything. I'll pay for the copying or whatever. If it's on computers, I'll sit in your office. Won't be a burden. What would PARA have said? What position would it have taken?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that PARA would cite to the statute the exclusive purpose language of the statute, which requires that a fiduciary purpose, that any request, any actions comply with a fiduciary purpose, and also that any request be made in a manner that is reasonable from an expense perspective.
So, according, following up on Judge Webb's, your position would be that that individual, whether it's Mr. Stapleton or any other trustee, has the burden of showing a proper purpose within the statute. Forget the money it would take for the moment.
Well, not just the statute, Your Honor, but well, first of all, yes, the statute certainly controls here. And one of the errors, I believe, in Mr. Stapleton's analysis is that he often confuses duties with purpose. In other words, one can stand up here and identify many fiduciary duties, as counsel did, but there's a distinction between duties and purpose. The accomplishment of those duties still has to satisfy the fiduciary purpose under the statute. And the five or six examples that counsel referred to, which counsel cites in their brief, is merely a recitation of duties. But once again, in their briefing, as Mr. Stapleton was unable to do at the board meeting, going beyond glittering generalities, going beyond identifying a particular duty, they are still unable to identify any nexus whatsoever, for example, between the zip code of a member who falls within that top 20%. I want to return to the burden of proof issue just for a moment. In this case, even if the para board had the burden of proof, we would respectfully submit that the para board satisfied that burden. In other words, Mr. Stapleton requested the information. There was a very deliberate process that para went through in order to make this determination, as you know. They held a board meeting. They gave Mr. Stapleton verbal as well as written opportunities to describe the purpose. They retained counsel. They took a number of steps before they made that decision, and all of that was at the instance of the other 14 para trustees. And so, to the extent that the board has the burden of proof, we would suggest that the evidence clearly shows that the board satisfied it here. Having said that, the burden of proof is properly on the individual who is seeking the information, because presumably that individual, when he or she says, I want this information on these top 20%. Of beneficiary earners. Presumably there's some proper fiduciary motivation for that request. From a practical perspective, the majority of those requests would probably be processed and there would not be an issue. But in a situation like this, where it is so unusual and there isn't a purpose given, and the board asks the individual to articulate a purpose, certainly in a situation such as this, the burden should rest with the trustee to satisfy his or her responsibilities under the statute and articulate a purpose. Thank you, members of the panel. For all those reasons, we ask that you affirm the trial court.
Can I ask you a question before you start?
Sure.
Do you agree that the Board of Para does not set the benefits or the qualifications or the requirements of benefits, but that's a legislative function?
It is.
So if his purpose, Mr. Stapleton says his purpose is to reduce benefits because they're too high, is that a proper purpose?
A trustee has the responsibility to approach the settlor of the trust if there are indications that the trust has long-term sustainability problems.
The settlor of the trust, in this case, I take it would be the General Assembly.
That's correct. And so, in this situation, the trustee, by the way, I see my clock hasn't started.
Can I need to deploy it again?
Start.
I could stand up here all day.
Lucky you.
A trustee, particularly a trustee in the treasurer's position, because the trustee has not extra responsibilities, but because the trustee has additional knowledge, it's incumbent on him to identify to the settlor and the trust if there are problems. And so if he takes the information that he gets from this and he goes to the legislature and says, these are the reasons, for example, salary spiking, for example, problems with the benefit structure, that I think the para is on a downward path, and he absolutely has a responsibility to take that to the settlor. He can't just sit idly by and say, well, we'll pay out the benefits as they're required by the legislature, and if the trust goes bankrupt, so be it. It's not my fault, it's the General Assembly's.
What does the zip code have to do with that analysis?
That, I think I'm in the same position as the treasurer in answering that question, and that is that I can't answer it until the information is actually provided.
Suppose they're all in the same zip code. What would that mean?
That's a fact that I'm really not prepared to address today. On remand, maybe it's something that we could address.
Well, wasn't he asked that at the meeting?
He was, but our position, actually, I don't know if he was asked that specific question, but the position is that it's not his responsibility to provide that information. He doesn't carry the burden. We'd ask that you reverse the order of the district court.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.